You're listening to the Mushroom Revival Podcast.
Today on the show, we're talking about fungal viruses, or mycoviruses, which are viruses that can infect fungi. Yes, you heard that right. Fungi can get viral infections too.
So the next time you're out foraging for mushrooms and you see mushrooms popping up 6 feet apart, you might be getting a sneak peek into the lockdown habits of mushrooms. Jokes aside, we have one of the only people in the world to study this field known as mycovirology to enlighten our myco-enthusiast listeners.
My name is Brenda Wingfield. I'm an African. I was born in Zambia, grew up in Rhodesia or Zimbabwe. I kind of studied genetics and biochemistry as a background. And ended up completing my PhD on killer yeasts. And killer yeasts are Saccharomyces cerevisiae with viruses in them. So that kind of is my quick summary. I'm currently a professor at the University of Pretoria, which is in Pretoria, South Africa.
And it's winter for you right now, so.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. We're also doing a third wave of COVID-19, so viruses are upper mind in our lives at the moment.
Indeed, it's a hot topic. Google yes. Trends, viruses at an all-time high. But this is such a unique way of framing it. You know, I never ever really thought about viruses and fungi. I've definitely considered that in animals and then further with plants, you know, having pathogens and stuff, but in a fungus, that seems to be the most foreign viral case for me personally. So before we get into fungal sickness, how did you get into mycology? We're so curious about your story.
Yeah, so as I've said, my classic training is in biochemistry and genetics. But for my PhD, I worked on killer yeasts. So killer yeasts actually are many things, but the killer yeasts I was working on were Saccharomyces cerevisiae that are infected with a virus. And these killer yeasts kill other yeasts, and they can cause then stuck fermentations. And I did my PhD in Stellenbosch, which is the center of our wine country. And stuck fermentations is not good for the wine industry, and you have to have money to do research. So that was my kind of venture into mycology. And then after my PhD, I started to actually collaborate with my husband, who is a classically trained plant pathologist. And I mean, I'd been telling him for years that DNA was where it all is. And certainly when we first got married, the technologies weren't there. But with time, we started to collaborate more. And one of the things we collaborated on is looking at some of the viruses in the fungi that are his particular interested. And he's interested in tree diseases, so particularly ascomycetes that cause tree disease. And that's kind of how I guess launched my career doing mycology, viruses, genetics, and generally having a lot of fun.
So killer yeasts. A quick aside on stuck fermentation, since we imagine this might be a case of mycovirus that directly impacts anyone out there who brews with the ever-present Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Stuck fermentation, simply put, is when fermentation halts and you are no longer getting alcohol and CO2 from your brew despite there being available sugars to convert. Generally, what's said to be at fault here is excessively high temperatures, a deficiency in essential nutrients like nitrogen, lack of oxygen, or some kind of contamination. But there may very well be another culprit that is unrelated to environmental conditions. Your yeast could be a killer yeast, which is caused by a double-stranded RNA virus that causes secretion of toxins that kill cells of the same or related species.
Stuck fermentation caused by killer yeast are more likely to be an issue with wild or naturally found ferments like those used in wine and barley. So what can we do about it? Well, not much other than just starting over. And if wild ferments continue to be an issue, sourcing a starter culture from a trusted supplier should be enough measure to ensure you're not brewing with infected yeasts. So fungi can get sick. which is pretty mind-blowing for us. It's the first time we're hearing about it. And so they can get viruses, they can get infections and more. What about cancer? You know, can they get other illnesses and diseases that we humans also get? And are there other illnesses or diseases that fungi get that, say, animals, plants, bacteria, other organisms cannot?
Well, certainly, okay, so fungi can become infected with viruses. And remember, not all of the viruses necessarily cause a disease. They're not all necessarily symptomatic. And that's also true of viruses in plants and animals. Not all viruses actually, you know, cause symptoms. And in actual fact, I'm arguably maybe more interested in the ones that don't cause symptoms. But in terms of, you know, can fungi get cancer? I suppose in terms of the fact that, you know, cancers really are mutations which allow cells to grow abnormally, yeah, you know, fungi can get mutations that can make them grow abnormally. But fungi are kind of neat in the fact that they have these hyphae and they can reproduce clonally. So they're not dependent on just having, you know, one body, one individual, which is the case, obviously, in case of humans. But fungi can kind of reproduce in many different ways. And in fact, that's one of my other interests is the whole mating system in fungi, which is also kind of cool. So, yeah, fungi are part of biology. I know my husband has been known to say that fungi are just insects without legs.
I love that.
And one follow-up question. In the classical sense, fungi cannot get cancer, right? Just the idea of cells mutating uncontrollably.
Oh, no, I think that can happen. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the entire fungus would be cancerous. It's not like a portion of the filaments would be cancerous, or how does that work?
I think it would be just portions, you know, because, okay. I mean, what would happen is that you would get... Remember, humans are very complex multicellular organisms, whereas largely speaking, fungi are very simple. So say, for instance, like happens in cancer, you would get a mutation in some gene that controls replication. That means that then the fungus is growing unreasonably fast. So then you would have a whole lot of fungal cells that would have the ability to grow really, really fast. But those cells wouldn't necessarily affect the rest of the mycelium because it would be quite localized and you might kind of just get suddenly things going a little bit haywire. So, I mean, I don't think in terms of what a cancer cell looks like. I mean, a cancer cell is just a cell that has a mutation that's not really behaving like it's meant to be behaving.
So you talked about how fungi are basically one big clone, and that's so true. I mean, in the lab, if we wanted to clone a shiitake mushroom, I could take from any part of that, right? It's in the filamentous stage or the fruiting stage, and I expect to get the same kind of genetics and strain.
Yeah, yeah. But they do mutate. I mean, it's quite well documented that with time, sometimes the cultural characteristics can degenerate, and I suppose that might be some kind of mutation, though, you know. But many of these things haven't been well studied. So sometimes the answer is we actually don't know the answer.
Definitely.
So I didn't know that one could get a virus and not have symptoms or cause any harm.
Yes.
So I'm curious, the two different sides, if one got a quote-unquote bad virus, what are the symptoms that fungi would get? You know, humans get fever, lethargy, aching joints, diarrhea, vomiting, etc. What happens with a fungi? And then on the flip side, you say there are viruses that don't cause harm or symptoms. What does that look like and why are they there?
Well, simplistically, the viruses that you can say maybe cause harm in fungi that have been studied are viruses that cause the fungi to grow more slowly or maybe not to be quite so virulent if you're talking about fungi that are in actual fact plant pathogens. So you can kind of say that the viruses just mess with the metabolism of the fungi and they can't reproduce quite so fast, and they can't cause the disease. And I, you know, the, in terms of causing the disease, the, you know, the potential there is to be able to use these viruses for biocontrol of certain plant pathogens. In terms of the viruses that don't cause any problems or that don't have any apparent symptoms, that's one of the reasons I think why fungal viruses have been so overlooked. Is in the viral world, everybody's looking for something that actually does something. But a number of the fungal viruses that I've described, you know, the virologists say to me, well, what does the virus do? And I'm going, well, it replicates in the fungus, and it doesn't seem to actually do anything. And you could maybe say that that is the ultimate parasite. It doesn't kill its host. It's going to be there forever.
Yeah, and I mean, when I'm thinking about good virus versus bad, I presume that a bad one would be aggressively hijacking the nucleus and breaking apart that DNA because it needs to replicate. But would a so-called good one just do this at a slower rate and just keep propagating until there's a viral community living in the cytoplasm, but it doesn't really interfere with the fungus's natural behaviors?
Yeah, if you think about, I mean, one of the basic problems is we probably don't know enough about many of these fungal viruses. So, you know, to label them good or bad is quite difficult. But quite often when you think of pathogens, that with time, they will actually move towards being more in some kind of symbiosis with their host, so that they don't kill their host, because it's actually not necessarily advantageous for a virus to kill its host. It's probably better for the virus to keep the host going. So, you know, viruses don't necessarily kill or are obviously detrimental. And, you know, and I know people often talk to me and they say, well, fungi are bad. I'm going, well, you know, some fungi are good and some fungi are not so good. It all depends on who you're talking to and what you're talking about.
Do the viruses, I don't know, this might be another thing we just don't know yet, but do they tend to just remain inside of the fungus, or do they eventually get out through them secreting metabolites or break through the cell wall somehow? Like, what have you observed, if anything?
Okay, so this is the one thing that really does make most of the fungal viruses very different. Is people have a tendency to think that all viruses are going to have coat proteins, and they're actually going to be spewed out of cells, and then they go off. And but like what COVID-19 is doing is, you know, people aspirate it into aerosols, and then the virus is actually able to move that way. Now, in actual fact, not all viruses necessarily move in the air or leave the host cells. In fact, there are a number of bacterial viruses that never actually leave the host cells. But we're not aware that there are any fungal viruses that ever leave the fungal cells. And in actual fact, a lot of the fungal viruses don't even seem to have a classic coat protein. So they don't necessarily form even viral-like particles in the fungal cells. They just seem to kind of sit there and replicate. How do they get transferred? Well, fungi do this thing called anastomosis, which means that they can share cytoplasm. And in order to be it for a fungus to anastomose, it has to be the same vegetative compatibility group, and there's quite a bit written about how fungi can recognize each other through this vegetative compatibility. Now, if you have one fungal strain that has the virus that then meets another fungal strain that is the same compatibility group, their hyphae can meet and join, and the cytoplasm is then shared. And then the virus is shared. So the virus kind of sneaks in that way. Now, the whole vegetative compatibility groups is quite interesting, because you're most probably aware that the fungi that cause rot in trees quite often will form what is called spalted wood. And that's quite pretty. And one of the reasons that spalted wood is quite pretty is that you see the zone lines between the different fungi that are in the wood. And those zone lines are as the result of the fungi not being the same vegetative compatibility groups. So they then don't recognize each other. And what happens then is you get a form of programmed cell death. And that those zone lines then are those dark lines that you see in the wood. So this compatibility and fungal anastomosis is actually been quite a bit that's been done on that in terms of how fungi recognize each other. But the compatibility is within a species. It's you don't normally find fungi recognizing, you know, different species, that compatibility would be within the same species.
So I understand how a virus could transfer from one strain of a fungus to another, but how does it get in there in the first place? Is the spore germinating and then it just is really weak and susceptible at some point?
Well, a lot of what we understand is that some of the spores contain the virus as well. And in actual fact, a classic example is the Lafrance disease, which is the disease of Agaricus bisporus. Now, Agaricus bisporus produces a lot of spores, basidiospores, and if the original strain of the fungus has the virus, that virus will actually be transferred to the basidiospores as well. And whether the virus is transferred to the spores actually does depend on the virus, but the idea is that essentially the viruses are there all the time and are transmitted through spores, or if they're not being transmitted through spores, they're transmitted through this anastomosis.
Lafrance disease. It essentially marks the birth of mycovirology as a distinctive science. It was the first recorded case of a mycovirus that had a significant impact on our lives. In the 1940s, Agaricus bisporus, that's the button mushroom, portobello mushroom, many of those farms were experiencing a number of hardships with their crops.
Scientists found three different viruses living in these fungi, and it resulted in symptoms like reduced yields, yellowed and atypical mycelial growth, water logging in the fungal tissues, deformations, premature fruiting, and reduced shelf life. We all know how disruptive COVID-19 was for our lives. Now think of the same situation for fungi. Although they might not need masks or social distancing, there are still measures we can take to ensure that we can be free of viruses. And I wish it was as easy as installing an antivirus software on our mushroom farm. But unfortunately, John McAfee didn't get there yet. So in terms of of fungi and also humans, what are the fungi and, you know, say these Agaricus cultivators, what are they both doing to protect against these viruses that could be detrimental for their growth?
As I understand it, the only thing that the cultivators of Agaricus bisporus can do to protect against infection is just to be really, really clean in terms of their cultivation. Because, you know, you could potentially actually get a spore just flying in from the outside, and that could have the virus. And I think this is actually quite a problem in virus cultivation, in mushroom cultivation, that they have to be on the constant lookout for any malformation of the mushrooms. And if they get it, then they just have to, I guess, you know, clean up that batch and sterilize everything.
And that's an edible species and another edible variety that pretty much all humans eat almost every day is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which you study pretty intensely, which it goes into brewing beer and baking bread and a ton of fermented foods and beverages that humans have loved for thousands of years. What would happen if we ate a fungi that was infected with a virus? Could that transfer onto us or make us sick in any way?
Unlikely. I mean, my knee-jerk kind of answer would be that if you ate bread or for that matter, drank beer, or I prefer to drink wine that happened to have some Saccharomyces cerevisiae that was infected with a virus, it's unlikely that anything would happen. Having said that, I mean, that's been the interesting thing and one of the reasons why I've started to get maybe more excited about fungal viruses is there's been quite a bit of suggestion now that we're starting to understand a little bit and understand this is still really, really new stuff. But while we're starting to understand a little bit more about these fungal viruses, what some researchers have done, in actual fact, it's a Chinese group who showed that Rhizoctonia solani, which is a plant pathogen, is in actual fact able to take up the cauliflower mosaic virus from plants that the Rhizoctonia, the fungus, is infecting, that Rhizoctonia can take up the virus from the plants. It can, in actual fact, that virus seems to be quite happy to replicate in the Rhizoctonia, and that those researchers, what they're able to do is that they were able to then isolate the cauliflower mosaic virus from the Rhizoctonia and reinfect the plants. So it kind of seems as if that cauliflower mosaic virus was quite happy to live in the fungus as well as to go back into the plant. So the one thing that we think might be happening with some of these fungi is that they might in actual fact be taking up viruses from whatever their hosts are. And that was one of the reasons that we started to talk about doing the work that we did on the armillaria viruses. So the whole story behind the armillaria viruses was that I had a conversation with one of the other few people who actually work on mycoviruses, Jaakko Hanschula, who is Finnish. And Jaakko had been doing some work on Heterobacillus anosum, which is not a fungus I normally work on because it's predominantly in the Northern Hemisphere. And he had some tentative evidence that it seemed that the Heterobacillus anosum isolates he was working with contained some of these Heterobacillus, a tree fungus, contained some of these tree viruses. And Jaakko was, he said to me, well, it would be quite neat to maybe look at our malaria. And there was a young researcher who now actually has a faculty position in Finland, Rika Linikoski, wrote a grant to look at the our malaria viruses. And we have a particularly interesting situation in South Africa is that the early European settlers brought into Cape Town fruit trees, citrus trees, and in so doing, they deposited a single clone of Armillaria mellia. And I think if I've got it right, Armillaria mellia is also known as the honey fungus, and people do eat it. And it's rather a nasty pathogen. But through some of the work that we've been doing is we know that Armillaria mellia is a single clone and it's been sitting in Cape Town for 300 years. It's been growing and getting bigger and bigger all the time. So Jaakko and I thought, well, that's kind of cool. Let's have a look and see if, what viruses actually exist in this Armillaria mellia. So that was one of the group, that was some of the isolates that Rika looked at in the study that she did on our malaria. And, initially it was, well, we had no idea what would be there. And it's only because of the modern techniques we have, the next-gen sequencing techniques that we have available, that we were able to determine that there are all sorts of viruses in our malaria mellia sitting in this clone that's been sitting in the southern tip of Africa for the last 300 years. What are they doing? How, have they picked up viruses from the plants in the area? Have they picked up viruses from animals? It's fascinating when you look at some of these viruses. Viruses get grouped together based on their DNA and RNA sequences, and certainly it's clear that some of these fungal viruses some of these viruses that have been found in our malaria, and in fact some of my other colleagues have done other work on some other fungi, that some of these viruses are more closely related to plant, other plant, well-known plant viruses. And there seems as if there might be evidence that some of these viruses are also closely related to you know, animals. And as I said, I mean, I found it was quite fascinating that the work that the Chinese group did on this work was published in PNAS. So this was not random research that was done. This was really high-end, strong research that Rhizoctonia solani was actually able to maintain cauliflower mosaic virus, which, you know, there was no reason to think that a fungus could actually be able to harbor this plant virus. So I think there's all sorts of interesting stuff out there that we're only just beginning to understand.
I was actually just reading a paper about fungal viruses in entomopathogenic fungi, or fungi that attack insects. And they were describing Buveria bassiana, one of the most famous entomopathogenic fungi in the world, infects many, many species of insects and all over the world. And they classified a few dozen different viruses in this Buveria bassiana. And surprisingly, there were a class that came from insects. And it sounds like in your case with the armillaria, is some of those are actually coming from plants.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like it's a defense mechanism, right? And this is the, you know, the honey mushroom or Buveria seems like this great foe, you know, that is almost impossible to defend against. But then there's this sneaky Trojan horse of a virus that can actually give, you know, these organisms a fighting chance against the honey mushroom or this entomopathogenic fungi. Well, is that right?
I guess that's one possible explanation. I'm not quite too sure that I think that it's as simple as that. You know, the fact, for example, that, you know, if I go back to the example I've used of the Rhizoctonia solani being able to maintain cauliflower mosaic virus, are the plants, you know, actively using these viruses to defend against the fungi? I think the viruses have just been quite sneaky and that they're moving from one cytoplasm to the other. Yeah.
Right. It's just a matter of perspective.
Yes.
Beautiful.
And I feel like this is some host specificity here, because there's, you know, there's viruses that animals have and plants have that, sure, we can ingest, but they're not going to really harm us. And people look for viruses in our stool. There's all kinds of viruses living within us. So, yeah, it's funny that these viruses almost know the conduits, so to speak, to continue replicating. And, wow, to use a fungus, that is brilliant, because especially something like our malaria, where it reaches far and wide and is hyper-aggressive. This is fascinating.
Yeah. No, it's but as I say, it's there are very, very few of us who've actually worked traditionally on mycoviruses. And in fact, I was wanting to have a conversation with Said Gabriel, who is a very well-known mycovirus, and I discovered that he actually died a couple of years ago. So I think there's one less person who has a focus on fungal viruses. But the one, and it's the reason why I actually wrote the article that you picked up on initially, is with the new technologies, our ability to understand what is actually inside organisms, and my interest is fungi, has increased dramatically. You know, we're able to understand what is inside our malaria in a way we could not have even dreamt of doing just even 10 years ago. So all these new sequencing technologies really have boosted our ability to understand what's going on, or at least what viruses are in there. Of course, then the next step, you know, the what question is arguably always the easy one. The next step is why and how. And that's always the more difficult questions to answer, but you know, what exactly are these viruses doing, and if anything, in these fungi, and for that matter, even in I have a colleague who works on maize well, maize viruses generally, and using some of these next-gen sequencing technologies, he discovered that his maize plants had all sorts of viruses that he had no idea were there. So this is a huge voyage of discovery that we're able to do, and it's incredibly exciting.
Yeah, it really is. So I'm curious if you have any suspicion for a case where we think that this metabolite or that this pathogen or some characteristic is due to the fungi when really it might be the virus. And we've seen this in plants a lot of times, like morning glory, for example, contains ergot alkaloids. And the more dissecting you do, you realize, well, it's actually the fungus, but we accredit it to the plant until we dug a little deeper. Are there any cases like that, that you think viruses are really what's behind something?
I'm not aware that there are any cases like that at all. But having said that, there are really only a handful of us in the world who've ever looked at fungal viruses. So, you know, it's absolutely not impossible that in some cases what the fungus is doing is in actual fact is the result of a virus. I suppose the one, just thinking about it in terms of the example of the killer viruses in Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Now, what happens with those viruses, the reason why they're called killer viruses is that the virus, one of the proteins that is produced, is a toxin. And that toxin kills other cells of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. That's the reason why the Saccharomyces that contain the virus cause what we call stuck fermentations, is because these strains of Saccharomyces are producing a toxin that kills the other Saccharomyces strains. So maybe that is sort of an example of, you know, the virus is producing the protein rather than the fungus, but I don't know of any other examples.
It seems quite a shame that only a few researchers are actually studying this. I mean, how different would the world be if, you know, the potato famine didn't happen, right? Or we still had tons of American chestnut trees, right? And it seems like there's tons of these massive fungal infections. My brain went to, you know, are there any people working on commercially producing a fungal virus to help as like a biocontrol? And is that too crazy? And would it just infect everything?
No, Alex, that's not crazy at all. So the classic biocontrol using a fungal virus is, of course, with the chestnut blight fungus. Now, the chestnut blight fungus, Craftnetria parasitica, landed in the US, I guess, probably about 150 years ago, and devastated the chestnuts. Some of the photographs that I've seen of what Craftnetria parasitica did to the chestnuts is really quite remarkable. Of course, the average person doesn't even know that this fungus exists, and definitely doesn't know about the fact that there was a potential of controlling this fungus using biocontrol. But in actual fact, by the time researchers actually started to even be aware that in Craftnetria parasitica there is a hypervirus, so that's a virus that causes reduced virulence, that the fungus is so diverse in the chestnuts, well, I guess there are hardly any chestnuts left in the US now, but the fungus is so diverse that to use the hypervirulent isolate it's not a commercially viable option, because as I said, the way in which these viruses are transmitted is through fungal anastomosis. So that means that if you had a biocontrol agent, it would be one vegetative compatibility group, and it would only be able to then transmit its virus to another vegetative compatibility group. So if you have a population of fungi that's very diverse and you're spraying on a biocontrol agent, you might take out, I don't know, probably less than 10% of the fungi. So biocontrol using the hypervirus, the Craftnetria parasitica hypervirus, has not been a viable option in the US. But in actual fact, it has been in the case of Europe. And the Europeans have very successfully controlled the chestnut blight fungus in Europe using hypervirulence. And wow. They were, you know, very active, certainly in the early years, in spreading the isolates of the virus that contained this virus. And it's been used very, very successfully. So one of my more recent interests is in an equivalent suggestion of that this could be used in Sclerotinia sclerotiorum, which is a very important agricultural pathogen. And some researchers have identified that the Sclerotinia also has a virus that causes reduced virulence, and that if you spray the, I don't know if they were actually spraying it, but if you apply the fungus that has the virus on plants that are infected with isolates of the fungus that don't have the virus, and assuming that they're the same vegetative compatibility groups, you in actual fact can essentially, I guess, cure or at least significantly reduce the disease that, that the fungus is causing. So now biocontrol has been this big thing in actual fact for fungal viruses, but it's really only been, as I've said recently, that we've really had the technology to potentially move much faster, because the techniques we had for manipulating viruses just weren't that powerful even 10 years ago.
So teaming with viruses to combat serious fungal infections, we do this today with bacterial infections in animals. It's not a new idea, and it's certainly a powerful one. Some ways this viral biocontrol can manifest in fungi include decreasing or slowing growth rates, preventing sporulation, reducing virulence, and reducing germination in daughter spores.
For more examples of viral biocontrol in fungi, be sure to check our show notes. And today we're using viruses to do genetic engineering, and I'm wondering if this is even a conversation yet within your community of mycovirus literate people, or what could you say about using viruses in even more unique ways to work with fungi?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. The original, you know, genetic modifications that have been done have been based, well, in fact, some of the original sequencing technologies were based on viruses. So I guess viruses come in so many different shapes, forms, and sizes, and that design to kind of take over the metabolism of whatever their host is. So being able to manipulate them does have some huge power to be able to do that.
So what about fungal immunity? How is it that these viruses are successful? And why don't we hear more about fungal illnesses? Part of this may be because mycology in general is a poorly studied subject, but it may also be accredited to the unique biosystems of fungi. So with an attempt to illustrate the fungal immune system, perhaps we can make decisions about how to work with fungi to support or suppress their activities. I would love to get some commentary from you on the fungal immune system and the fungal immunity. Like how does that work? Is it, you know, the hyphal tips and the cell walls recognizing molecules and things that it doesn't want in, and then it just plays the bouncer? Or what, is there any kind of uniqueness to the fungal immune system that we should talk about?
My understanding is that the only fungal immunity system is based on this whole vegetative compatibility group, so that fungi protect themselves by being, there's a whole lot of proteins, quite often they call them the HET proteins, that are involved in recognition. So if a fungus doesn't recognize another individual within a species, then these HET proteins come into play, and they cause then what is essentially programmed cell death, so that you don't get the mixing of the cytoplasm. And this is seen as an immunity of kinds. And this is not that different to what you see in plants, actually, and animals. They call it the innate immune response, and so certainly fungi have those. Now, I mean, in actual fact, I was just listening to an interview of Jennifer Doudna today, and she was talking about CRISPR and talking about the bacterial immune system, which is essentially CRISPR, which I was actually thinking, yeah, well, I mean, it's not impossible that fungi don't have something that we just don't know about. But certainly we're not aware that there is anything other than this innate immune kind of recognition system that comes into play.
One of the most fascinating episodes that we've had was on the mycobiome. So our own fungal communities in our own human bodies, and just learning how complex and intricate that system is. So we've been talking a lot about fungi, you know, and plants and some insects and things like that. But I'm curious, in our own human bodies, are people developing viruses to attack, say, candida or quote unquote bad fungi in our systems? I know candida is, you know, everyone has it, and it's only quote unquote bad when it's in overgrowth, right? But then on the flip side, you know, are there any viruses that only attack the quote unquote good fungi in our body? And is anyone working on any, you know, vaccines for those specific viruses that attack the good fungi in our body?
I think the short answer to the question is Alex, no, I don't think anybody's doing that kind of work. Control of fungi is a really hot topic now, and I think there's a much greater appreciation of the fact that we really need to understand, in terms of medicine, human medicine, what fungi are doing. But the bottom line is, in terms of human pathogens, fungi are considered to be, largely speaking, very, very minor, and most of the fungi that cause problems in humans is as the result of humans being somehow immunocompromised. I mean, you were talking about candida. It only kind of takes over if something else is out of balance. So the reverse is actually true in terms of plants. The most important plant diseases are fungi, but the most important animal diseases are probably viruses, followed by bacteria, whereas for plants, the fungi are the most important pathogens, followed by viruses and largely speaking, bacteria. There are limited number of bacteria that actually cause plant disease in comparison to the number of fungi that are out there. So it is a bit of a different situation.
The next question I have about fungal viruses is, do you suspect that most fungi have this innately? Have you ever screened fungi and not found RNA viral markers? And do you think this is more or less prominent in nature versus like a lab or cultivated?
Okay, well, the one thing I can say is that some researchers have partially, in fact, answered that question. So researchers who are collaborating with the Joint Genome Institute, what they published last year was they had a look at RNA sequences from early diverging fungal lineages. And there's been a fantastic project that the JGI, funded, called the 1,000 Fungal Genome Project. And part and parcel of this project, that they did a lot of RNA sequencing work. So I've collaborated with Joey Spatafora. Joey's very passionate about his fungi. So what they had a look at is, the question was quite simple, is could they see signatures of fungi in these early diverging lineages? And they had the RNA data. So this would have not necessarily, I mean, this whole 1,000 Fungal Genomes Project has been a very, very big project, and it hasn't only included fungi that would be kind of lab rats, so lab strains, but included all sorts of interesting fungi from across the fungal kingdom. And what these researchers published in that article was the fact that about 30% of the fungi, so 30% of the species that they looked at in these early diverging lineages of fungi contained signatures, well, basically RNA sequences that of viral origin. So the one thing I do need to mention is that you get double-stranded DNA viruses, you get single-stranded DNA viruses, you get double-stranded RNA viruses, and you get single-stranded RNA viruses. So what we're able to do with the RNA sequencing technology is we're able to see the messenger RNA that these viruses are in actual fact producing. So these might not necessarily be RNA viruses. They may in actual fact be DNA viruses. But viruses do have different kinds of genomes. So my thumb psych is that there are a huge number of viruses out there in fungi in nature. It's not just because people have picked up things in the laboratory, but there are clearly fungi that don't contain any signatures that suggest that they are in actual fact infected with a virus.
All right. And as you stated before, this field is so nascent and there's very few people who are actually paying attention. But this is one of the reasons why we wanted to cover it. You know, our podcast is all about putting a spotlight on these niche mycological sciences and research and development that could mean something really meaningful one day. So with that in mind, what do you think that your field or this topic needs the most? Like, what types of scientists, and for anyone listening out there who's interested in knowing more and contributing, what would you say to them?
I think my knee-jerk reaction is probably grant funding.
Right, of course.
Grant funding and human capital resource development. You know, get all those young people who are passionate and excited about biology, you know, get them into doing research to understand what's going on. One of the things that I've been very mindful as we've gone through the COVID-19 pandemic is there's currently a huge focus on viruses, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but the majority of the money and focus is going into human viruses. Now, we're just one species amongst a whole diversity of species, many of which are going extinct as we speak. So the more we can study things before everything disappears, I think the better off we are, because it's only through studying these different organisms that we can understand what's going on. And, you know, you never know when you're studying something what applications you might find. A lot of our grant funding is very strongly focused on applications, and you know, it's focused on keeping humans alive, not necessarily actually even in keeping plants alive. It's one of the things that I work on tree diseases most of the time, and you know, sometimes people say to me, well, you know, so what? I'm going, in fact, that's maybe this is a quotable quote for your audience. But what I do like to say to people is, you know, if trees produced something useful like a Wi-Fi signal, we would all plant them. Instead, they just produce oxygen, which we breathe.
That's a beautiful quote. That's wonderful. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Fungal viruses are a scientific niche within a niche, but studying them has potent potential and is likely a part of every mycologist's work, whether they know it or not. But how do we best use the little bit of information out there? Is it applicable or relevant? Well, maybe.
At MR, we believe that sheer acknowledgement of a science can help public understanding. And for those listening with a will and a way to work with mycoviruses, we hope this episode was helpful. If you like what you hear, you can support the show and keep content like this coming by visiting our website, mushroomrevival.com, and purchasing any of our super functional mushroom products to support your energy, focus, calm, immune system, and defense against occasional stress with the power of mushrooms. Podcast listeners get a special discount for 10% off. Just enter MR Podcast at checkout. That is MR Podcast, all capital letters, at checkout.
You can also support us by rating and reviewing. These go a long way, y'all, and we always appreciate feedback to improve our content.
Seriously, seeing reviews light up our world. We share them around with our coworkers, and it literally makes our day. So please share it. Leave your reviews. Tell your friends, your family, random people passing on the street how much you love mushrooms. It really goes a long way. If not just lighting up our world, but for the fungi. As always, much love, and may the spores be with you. Thank you.